Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my good friend and co-host, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
Hello. Very good.
I am Mark Bigney. A little bit of follow-up from last week's review of Envelopes of Cash. As everyone will be well aware, we are not exactly replete with what you would call sports men. I am not what you would call a sports enthusiast. I am not a man of sport. And so there were some aspects of the theming of Envelopes of Cash, although overall I praised it as one of the best themed board games of the past few years. There were a couple elements that didn't quite make sense to me, and the designer Andy Schwartz was kind enough to illuminate me on some of the finer elements of sports ball. One of them is as to the regional scoring, and it is helpful, I can phrase this in the cynical way, it is helpful to lock down a region for your university in terms of recruitment, and therefore every young promising athlete just thinks of your school as the place to go, thereby further limiting the academic horizons of all these young student athletes and ensuring that the pipeline to exploit their likenesses and their athleticism is undisturbed by anything like critical thought. The other thing that I was concerned about, or at least didn't make much sense to me, was the notion of using illicit payments to put out things like a chancellor or a provost. And Andy Schwartz pointed out that the design intent that did not communicate to me by my playings was that this wasn't, you know, having a chancellor or provost at your university. It was having a suborned and corrupted.
A buttered.
Exactly. A well-buttered, properly incentivized provost or chancellor. And with those provisos in mind, I thought it was necessary to give a brief addendum to the most excellent game and most excellent satire of Envelopes of Cash. Thus armed, I think I'll be better able to appreciate the, what's the word I'm looking for, terrible things that one does in the context of playing that game.
Well, if you're a provost and you're not driving a Porsche, are you actually a provost?
This is an excellent question. I think you missed your calling, Walker. I think you should have been a metaphysician. So, we're going to talk about games this week. We're going to talk about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Aeurus, the game we reviewed 1 year ago. We're then going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic this week. This is actually a topic that I've been thinking about a fair bit lately, specifically in the context of games that we've been playing and other games we haven't. And we've never done it before. This is not a revisiting something over the course of our, how long have we been doing this? 30 years. And we're going to be talking about deck building.
All sorts of deck building.
So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly. 1 year ago, we reviewed a game called, I haven't heard, like, I don't think I've played it.
Just like Heat Pedal.
Guards of Atlantis 2.
Yes, it was our game of the year of 2022. I play it as often as I humanly can, which is sadly not very often. It is a big, intimidating box. It needs even numbers of players, and ideally, you want to have an equivalent number of experienced players and inexperienced players. With those limitations, it is sometimes hard to get to the table, which is a shame. But I have been able to play it about half a dozen times or so, at least. I'd have to check my notes.
It's a board game that excellently mimics a MOBA-style game, like League of Legends. And you have minions pushing back and forth between the two bases. There's no towers in this one, but you still have different types of minions pushing back and forth, and we get to play the heroes as they jump across and try to eliminate the minions and each other for points and pushes.
And it is a marvelous masterclass of tension, of player interaction, of risk-reward, of action efficiency, and of cool leveling up. And I have an enthusiasm for the structure of MOBA-style games. I don't actually like playing the specific MOBA games. In that, I am unlike Walker, who plays League of Legends all the time. In fact, I believe he's currently halfway through a match right now.
Shh. I'm pushing a tower.
Yes. In his fevered dreams, he mutters about last hits and pushing lanes. So yes, Guards of Atlantis 2, it's going to be getting more content. There was a successful crowdfunding campaign for a reprint and some balance adjustments and some new characters. I'm looking very much forward to getting all of that. And I make it very much a priority to play Guards of Atlantis 2 whenever I can, which, as I say, sadly is not often enough for my tastes.
And that was the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Now, on to the games we played this week. Mark, what did you play?
I played Aqua Biodiversity of the Oceans again. So this is a review copy we got from the publisher, and it is a light tiling, nature-themed game, again under the Cascadia to Calico axis. This is very light and approachable, much closer to the Cascadia end than to the Calico. I was worried that I hadn't given it a fair shake, because I kept thinking about the structure of the scoring conditions, and it is at least the case that in Aqua Biodiversity, you don't have the scoring conditions handed to you at the start of the game. There are these possible scoring conditions that you build towards, and then you further build to try to maximize the scoring off of them. So, you know what? I'm going to try some of the other scoring conditions in the box, because there's a bunch. As Walker would say, there is a plethora. And we played the first time with scoring conditions 1 through 6. This time I played with scoring conditions 7 through 12, and they were bad. They were not good. They were bad. They were less interesting. The one thing that I kind of sort of liked about Aqua is gone. So there's this idea in Aqua of you form a pattern to make a small animal, and then if you make a pattern of small animals, you can build a large animal, and in at least the scoring conditions 1 through 6, that large animal will then score other conditions elsewhere. And so there's a trade-off involved of whether you want the small animals for other exogenous reasons, or sometimes they're even just flatly worth more points than the large animal you're replacing them with, but you get this extra scoring condition. So there's this kind of trade-off and question about risk. The scoring conditions 7 through 12 do not incentivize you to build large animals at all. In point of fact, they disincentivize you from building large animals because all of those scoring conditions relate to having small animals next to other small animals of that type.
Oh.
And so in addition to not making you build large animals, it's this weird set of superficially easy to remember but difficult relations. So green gives you bonus points for being next to yellow. Yellow gives you bonus points for being next to pink. Pink gives you bonus points for being next to blue. And so every time I'm building, I'm thinking, wait, do I want to build blues next to pinks or pinks next to blues? Which way is the direction going? So you have these six unidirectional relationships going on. And not only so it's more difficult to internalize and it's less interesting. And so, look, it's fine. It's one of those very pleasant family weight sort of placement games. The Vincent Dutré art is very cool, but the 1 through 6 scoring conditions are kind of vaguely interesting at times, and the other scoring conditions, in my experience, are not. I don't know, man. It's all right. Not particularly inclined to go back to it. And that was my further experience with Aqua Biodiversity of the Oceans. Now, to be fair, I'm not particularly jazzed about Cascadia or Calico or most of the other games in that ilk either. Gun to my head, I'd probably prefer Aqua to Cascadia, if only because, as I say, you get to build towards the scoring conditions rather than them being handed to you. But it's not my cup of tea, and I do like tile-laying games, so take that for what it's worth. That is Aqua Biodiversity in the Oceans, designed by Dan and Tristan Halstead, published by Sidekick Games.
I also played a review copy of Bloodstone. This is designed by Martin Wallace and put out by Wallace Designs, and I streamed it. So if you're interested in seeing it, come on by to the YouTube channel. And I've been playing the solo mission. So this is the third solo mission. This is sort of like you've conquered large parts of the land, and now they're all pushing back. So you've got the Hill Giants swarming in from the north, and the Dragon Lords swarming in from the south, and you've got to hold out for a certain amount of time for what in the game mechanic is for your bag to refresh three times. If you can make it for your bag to refresh three times, then you've won the game. And your bag refreshes every time it runs out of tiles. So I sort of tried this strategy of just getting as many units on the board as I possibly could. Therefore, there'd be less tiles in my bag and it would just refresh faster. And it seemed to work all right. Once again, it's just these combats just get so tedious, and especially when you're doing it solo and you're getting swarmed on all sides. You're doing like three or four combats a turn and it was getting awfully tedious, and much like it is in the normal game. And the combat is just not as rewarding as I wish. I'm just not going to be a broken record saying the same things over and over. I really love the production of Bloodstone. There are some good things there, but just overall, it just doesn't hit the way I wish it would. So that'll be the end of Bloodstone for now. Anyway, I'm not going to do any more solo missions. Going to play some Kingdom Rush. So if you have any interest in Kingdom Rush, come by on Wednesday. We're going to be starting that up. Speaking of Kingdom Rush, we did play it and we streamed it on Saturday. It's based off of a computer app or a computer game where it's sort of tower defense. You have all these different types of units streaming down these paths. You put towers in their way, much like every other tower defense. But the difference or the hook in this one is that you have a champion that you can move around. They do all sorts of special abilities and spells. And throughout the campaign on the video game, you level up your champion. They do more and more powerful things. And they mimic this quite well in the board game. So they have the cards of all the minions streaming in, and now it's a tetromino sort of puzzle. You are launching spells and missiles and arrows at these cards, and they're all these different shapes, and you have to cover all the units on the card to destroy it before they swarm down through the exit and you lose the points. I think they do a great job. It was well enjoyed by all. Yeah, so that's Kingdom Rush Elemental Uprising. It was a Kickstarter that I just got in. It is designed by Lara Cameron, Helena Hope, and Senfu Lim.
Played another game of Imperium Horizons. This is a review copy by the publisher. I have been playing Imperium Horizons at least twice a week since I got it. I am a massive fan of the Imperium system, and Horizons absolutely doubles down on what makes Imperium great while also adding this notion of trade. I was skeptical about trade at the beginning, but the more I play it, I appreciate it more and more. It is definitely not a very approachable system. It is not something that makes a whole lot of sense or you're apt to make a lot of use in your first or possibly even your second play, even if you're very familiar with the systems involved in Imperium. At least that's been my experience. The people that I've shown it to that are experienced with the game system don't interact much with trade at the beginning, but then they might start to get slightly more comfortable with it. That's been my experience personally. First couple of games with trade routes, I didn't really experiment with them much, but the more and more I play, the more I appreciate the extent to which they can serve as force multipliers or additional options in your turn. One of the problems is that it works better in multiplayer games because there are more trade routes available and more people might be inclined to pursue that avenue. So if there's only one opponent and they decide not to pursue trade routes, well, then the mechanism doesn't really get to shine the way that it is intended to. But if you're playing with multiple opponents, then there's more opportunity for that. The problem is that ever since the beginning, Imperium has not really been a game that shines at multiplayer. It is best solo or two-player in my experience. I am willing to play a three-player. I have played it before four-player, and it worked, but that is not its best configuration. And I absolutely love the fact, just before I let Walker complain about him not enjoying Imperium, which is fine, that they really are spending a lot of time and effort to flesh out the civilizations you don't typically find in your classic Western civilization game. You don't just have the Mauryans, but you also have the Guptas. You don't just have the Persians. You also have the Sassanids. You have the Wagadu. You have the Taino. You don't just have the Qin Dynasty. You also have the Tang Dynasty. It's really, really impressive. And I really love exploring these different peoples at different stages of their civilizational development and how they've been modeled in the context of Imperium. I've talked a lot about the theming of Imperium Classics and Legends and Horizons as a civilization game. And I really do think that it is the very best themed civilization game that I have ever played. I absolutely adore Tresham's civilization. But nonetheless, it is a very abstracted 30,000-foot view of civilizational development. In Imperium, you do get to have the added personality of, you know, people like Julius Caesar showing up, people like Chandragupta showing up, people like Chandragupta II showing up, the revenge. But they don't serve as immortal god kings. They show up, they do something impressive, and then they go into your history. That history element really manages to tie everything together. And I am looking forward to exploring yet more of the new factions in Imperium Horizons. I'm also looking forward to replaying some of the factions that I've already played. I've now played as the Magyars, I played as the Guptas, I played as the Sassanids, I played as the Akkadians. Anyway, I am all in for the system. So long as Nigel Buckle and David Surtsey keep designing new decks, I am going to be doing it. I think the next time I play, I might try some of the weird ones, like Martians or Cultists. But I didn't want to go in first. I didn't want that to be my first experience with the new set. Walker, what are your thoughts on Imperium Horizons?
It's just not for me. I don't think there's any big problems with it. If it's very heads down,
yes.
There's very little to none player interaction.
Absolutely.
And just in the end for me, it just came down to I just didn't care. Like there was just
that's a pretty damning indictment.
Well, I just didn't find any. I can see where other people would find interest in it. I just don't. That's all. it was just so heads down that it just wasn't for me.
Well, there are lots of heads-down games we enjoy. Do you have any ability to speculate as to why this heads-down game...
No particular mechanic that I enjoyed manipulating.
Okay.
Right? There was, you know, put the cards out, take the cards back. You know, look at these cards. Now you get to play those ones. And it, you know, it just wasn't this...
I don't know, Walker. Imperium is awesome.
I can see where some people would. I'm not saying there's any part of it bad. It's just a very not for me game.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say that any of your specific criticisms are ill founded. As I say, it's extraordinarily multiplayer solitaire. The trade module sort of takes a little bit of that edge off, but you're not gonna experience the trade module. You're not gonna have the bandwidth for it to really exploit it until you're a few games deep into the system. And at that point, if you weren't grabbed, then that's that. And with three players, the downtime is considerable, and so definitely better with two or solo. But if the fundamental systems don't appeal to you, then there's not much to be done about that. That is Imperium Horizons by Nigel Buckle and David Surtsey, published by Osprey Games.
Now, you and I got Tokyo Highway Rainbow City back onto the table. This is a dexterity game that sort of where you're creating this crazy interlocking highway system with these long, thick popsicle sticks that have these really nice rubber ends on them, and they're interweaving in between these buildings and through rainbows, and there's a reason to put roads in certain places. Yep. And reason to put certain cars on certain roads. There's all these different goals you're trying to hit. If you put the same type of car over someone else's same type of car, then they have to give you pieces. And there's a lot of strategy on seeing how many pieces you have left and manipulating your two special yellow discs just right. There's lots there. It's such a turnaround from the first edition. I love both game times we played Tokyo Highway Rainbow City.
Yes, if you were disappointed by the original publication of Tokyo Highway, if you thought, well, this is visually interesting, but there's not really much going on, then Rainbow City might be the game that you are waiting for. I would encourage you, if you're at all curious, to take a look at an end state. It really is visually arresting. And the more I think about it, I'm struck by the fact that Tokyo Highway Rainbow City, like some dexterity games, capture some of the great elements of tabletop miniatures games. Allow me to explain. Primarily by virtue of the fact that they force you to evaluate the spatial parameters of how to engage with your opponent. So specifically in the context of Tokyo Highway, there's a non-trivial amount of blocking going on because you cannot build directly over existing pylons erected either by your opponent or yourself. But at the same time, you want to be crisscrossing roads. And that dynamic forces you to look at the table and evaluate the spatial parameters of play in a way that kind of reminds me of evaluating lines of fire in a more traditional tabletop miniatures game. It is also similar to a tabletop miniatures game in a way that some people will appreciate and some people won't, in that setup is very consequential. The added terrain offered in Rainbow City is not just a visual appeal, but it also is grist for considerable scoring opportunities. And if a particular piece is placed too far away, well, it's not going to be worth anyone's time to go interact with it. But on the other hand, If it's too close, it can be trivially scored by somebody. And so figuring out where to put things is, I don't think, perfectly transparent. But that's part of the game. You know, it's not like you just scatter them randomly. You're supposed to place them as players in various parts. And so I think I'm going to be spending more time next time we play paying attention to how those specific pieces are going to be played so as to try to maximize my ability to score off of them and minimize other people's abilities.
Because that part is definitely mimics in traditional miniature wargaming.
Yes.
Is when you're putting out the objectives on the board at the beginning and you're figuring out, well, I can race out to get that one. I'll put this one by the trees so it's harder for them to get.
Absolutely.
And that part of it is almost exactly the same. So this is Tokyo Highway. I want to make sure I say it's a review copy that we got from Itten Games. And I'll play it anytime.
I think I still prefer Crash Octopus, but those are two very, very excellent dexterity games that Crash Octopus as well gives me that kind of miniature gaming vibe in a lot of ways about cover and sight lines.
I believe it's still up on Kickstarter right now.
It is still up on crowdfunding right now. You can get an expansion for the base game of Tokyo Highway, or you can get a new base edition with all the Rainbow City stuff available. We played another game of Sail. This is by Akiyama Koryu and Kozu Yusei, and it is a two-player co-op trick-taking game. And I'm beginning to reevaluate the extent to which various combinations are worthwhile. A lot of what drives Sail is that you're basically forming recipes based on what cards were involved in the trick. Right? If I win the trick with a cannon and I beat another cannon, something happens. And I think I'm overvaluing that particular combination. But what you definitely don't want to do is end up in the situation, and there's a small number that admit of this result, whereby somebody wins a trick and nothing happens. That is the worst case scenario and is apt to spell doom. Now, I guess actually the absolute worst case scenario is to suffer damage when you're not equipped to suffer the damage. But I think why we lost, and we did lose, which is great, I find losses often more interesting than repeated wins, that we had too many tricks where nothing happened. And I really think that trying to play to the it's one of those trick-taking games where you pass a card to somebody else. I've been playing trick-taking games one way or another for at least a quarter century. I have no conception of how to pass cards in a partnership trick-taking game well at all. There are some people, like the hardcore bridge players or what have you, you know, someone passes them a red five, and they're like, I know the entire contents of my partner's hand. Let's go. Nat 20. But in my case, I'm like, I know I want to be void in some suits. I guess I'll just get rid of this card, which is not a pro-social way to play with your partner. Anyway, I'm very much looking forward to more Sail. It's quick. It's cheerful. It's got different scenarios, and we can escalate the difficulty. Any further thoughts on Sail, Walker?
Nope. It is lots of different player powers, and also on top of that.
They don't trigger very much.
No, but it's something.
It is. I agree. It is a thing. It is a thing.
And the color palette is amazing. Yeah, it's a really neat little game.
Little indeed. That is Sail.
We also got For Science back to the table. This is designed by R. Eric Ross and put out by Grey Fox Games. It is another fantastic dexterity game where you're using these giant blocks to sort of mimic genome chains and create antidotes.
Cures for various diseases.
Yes.
You are 3D printing cures for diseases.
And so you
Look
first...
at you whipping out all these fancy science terms.
I know. We know we're on top of this. First,
what's this we? I studied the humanities. I don't know anything about this stuff.
First, you're designing
genomes? These
genomes with cards.
Cure? Disease? Sorry.
You're designing these cures with these cards, creating these...
Cards?
Crazy shapes. And then someone will suddenly call out and say, I'll build that. And so they have to mimic exactly what on the cards. It'll show like the orange block is there and it can only touch the green and the purple block. And then the purple block's got to be on top of the yellow block and the star.
But the yellow block can't touch the green
And the star is in this ridiculous position that will just make the whole thing crash. And then as soon as they think they
don't
have it.
Don't sleep on the stars because they have to be standing up.
Yes.
It's not good. It's bad.
And then they'll call out, check it. And then the other player has to, you know, go through the little blueprint.
Check it, but don't breathe.
Don't breathe. And then there's a side game going on top of that where there's a spatial puzzle where you're trying to, you know, encapsulate all these diseases. And that's the main win condition, I guess, because when you build the the chains that give you opportunity to get more tiles to put into your spatial puzzle. And yeah, every time I play it, it's all timed. I love For Science.
I love For Science too. One of the reasons why we don't get to play it as often as we would like is, on the one hand, it's super niche, real-time cooperative dexterity game. But on the other hand, it is a 15-minute game in a massive box. There's no way to make the box smaller. It's full of wooden blocks. But it's not the kind of thing you can toss into a bag. Which is one of the reasons why I appreciate Paku Paku so much. I'm not saying that Paku Paku is as good as For Science. It is absolutely not as good as For Science. Few games are as good as For Science. But Paku Paku, you can just toss into a bag or toss into a some kind of conveyance. For Science, you're committed to that. You're going to know that's in your game bag when you bring that somewhere. But yes, brilliant game, designed by Eric Royce, who, full disclosure, is a personal friend of mine. And we don't tend to play much with the events, so that may be the next level of elaboration, because I really appreciate the events because they are, what's the word, stupid.
Silly.
Yes. They're precisely the kind of silly that I appreciate. I mean, the game is already very silly. You can play as the lab's cat who knocks things over.
I played as the coffee guy.
Walker played as the coffee guy. If your hand is full, you can say, coffee, please, and then he can hand you a card. His presence doesn't allow you to draw extra cards. No, no, no. It allows you to request extra cards from the coffee guy.
It was fantastic.
That is For Science by R. Eric Royce. We played Charioteer again. This is a review copy from GMT Games, designed by Matt Calkins, designer of the truly excellent Sekigahara. I can't say it enough. If you're jaded on historical war games or enthusiastic about historical war games, you owe it to yourself to try Sekigahara. It's truly interesting. Charioteer, however, is different. It is a race game. And one of the things that I was really curious about was getting it back to the table with the same players. Would the level of interest maintain, and what would the playtime be? And I was very, very pleased to observe that the playtime was around 75 minutes, which is very, very brisk for a three-lap game, and it nonetheless had a sense of development, because you have these skills that are constantly leveling up, and for a long time, they give you a +1 to their movement. But then when they get to the last column of development, suddenly they now give you +3, or +5, or +7, and that can...
This is if you remember to move them. Just saying.
Yes, I don't know why, but people have the devil of a time remembering to advance their skill token. At the end of every turn, you advance a skill token. Just, what kind of move did you do? Did you do a green move? Advance the green skill token. Did you do a red move? Advance the red skill. Did you do a yellow move? Guess what you get to do, Walker?
Advance the black one.
Close.
Damn it.
Okay, now I seem to understand why there are difficulties with the rules. But I really like Charioteer. It is rapidly becoming my favorite race game. It is very well done. The only other race game that comes to mind that can even remotely compete for it in my affections is Quest for El Dorado, which is barely a race game and also designed by Reiner Knizia. So this is high praise indeed. I talked about it last time that there was a design ambit on the back of the rulebook in the form of the designer notes, and Matt Calkin said, I want to make it so that hand management is meaningful, and so that mitigates the luck of the draw, and I want to make it so that there's a sense of progression, and I want to make sure that it plays quickly. And reading the back of reading that, I was like, those all sound like ambitious goals. That's what every designer of every race game always seems to say, and they almost never pull it off. And here we are with Charioteer, and it pulled it off.
It's true, and it's easy to teach, quick to play, as long as everyone's like sort of chipping in and making sure it moves along at a good pace.
Yes, it's got simultaneous play, and then you resolve in sequence, and those kinds of games with high player count can drag, but we were playing with 5, and we were not exactly cracking the whip. See, that's a reference.
That's the callback tie-in, yeah.
Yeah, like exactly. That. People say I don't know about sports, but clearly I know a lot about sports. And it nonetheless moved at a very, very rapid pace. If we were playing with 3 or 4 players, we could probably knock it out in 60, no problem.
I agree.
And Charioteer is really, really well done. It's a shame that it's not getting more attention. I think part of that is the publisher. People don't turn to GMT Games for non-historical war games, which is a shame. They've got some really interesting designs. And even amongst their historical war games, they've got some really interesting crossover stuff. But, you know, it's a niche hobby, and people tend to associate publishers with certain things. And I can certainly understand that. And it's one of those GMT games with a mounted map, so it's not even that you have to worry about, you know, cardboard chits on paper, which I'm perfectly willing to do, but a lot of consumers aren't. Charioteer, I think it needs more eyes on it.
Agreed. I got to show Mark Great Western Trail New Zealand. This is designed by Alexander Pfister and put out by Eggerspiel. And It's very similar to Great Western Trail with a few extra hooks. Now you get to shear your sheep while you're bringing them to market. And for now sure. You're sailing boats instead of going onto trains. And now you're doing a little bit more of deck building. There's lots of extra cards that you can now add to your deck. And it doesn't bloat them down because every time you play them, you draw another card. So it just moves that part of the game a little more briskly. So you're not worried about, you know, losing in on your sheep. And the game plays a little bit longer, but I think it keeps you more, you know, in the game with lots of different things to do.
So the fundamental design parameters of Great Western Trail since the beginning have been trying to find a good balance for having a good hand of cows or sheep versus everything else in the game. I think the perception was amongst people who played the base game to death was that cows were just too good. That you just focus on cows, get a great herd of cows, get a whole bunch of cowboys, and buy the best cows and just race to, Was it Kentucky? I can't remember, in their backwards cattle drive universe of Great Western Trail. But when or Kansas City? There's no such thing as Kentucky City.
No.
Okay, I know even less about geography than I know about sports, and that is saying something. I think I could name the city in which I am currently located. Past that, I don't know. And the expansion to Great Western Trail, I think, for my tastes, pulled it too far in the other direction. It made it so that cows suddenly were a thing among many. And what New Zealand does, to its credit, is it's still all about the animals you've got, but now there's a different thing you can do with the animals, namely shear them. And so basically, you now have two different things you can do, but you're still operating the same parameters of the deck. That part I really appreciated. It made it so that different professions were valuable. It made it so the different spots were more valuable. There were different ways to go about it, but you nonetheless felt that you were still operating on the same central premise, and it didn't degenerate into something that felt a little bit more like Point Salad or, oh, you thought you knew how you were playing, but you didn't set yourself up properly, so you get no points at all for you, sucker, which was somehow sometimes how I felt with the expansion to Great Western Trail. And ultimately, thus, I think it comes together to form my preferred version of Great Western Trail. It's really well done. Now, I'm not as enamored with the extra cards as you are. I don't actually think, we'll be talking more about this later, I suspect, that they add considerably to the decision space of deck building precisely because they don't bloat your deck. There's no reason not to take the cards. If you can take lots more cards, you should. There's no opportunity cost to taking them. It's just a way to intermittently ping some other bonus. You get a special card that gives you money. It's just you're getting some income at an irregular time. And so it is A, random, and B, not interesting. I did it, of course. I went up that bird track. You gotta have the bird.
The bird. Lots of bird.
Lots of bird. Bird is great. I loved bird. So I had bird cards, and they were great. They'd show up, they'd say hello, and then they left. But again, I didn't find it an interesting trade-off. Normally in a deck-building game, when you purchase a card, there's some consideration about whether you want to be living with this thing. In Great Western Trail, New Zealand, it was just, more cards the better, as far as those cards are concerned. It's not a problem. I just didn't find it especially interesting in terms of leveraging the deck-building. Now, I didn't... One aspect that I found a little daunting was I didn't really ever get a good sense about where my points were coming from. Like, at the end of the game, we did final scoring, and I'm like, what? For everyone, not just me, but, like, you had okay. Because, and again, this is an evolution from the base formula, in Great Western Trail, the base game, most cities to which you delivered beef, as I recall, would give you points in an escalating way. In New Zealand, you have to get to a pretty high threshold before any of them start getting you points. And I looked at the board, and based on my past experiences with the other Great Westerns Trail, that's how you pluralize things,
yes,
that this was going to be a low-scoring game, that scrabbling for 5 points was going to be very, very significant. This was not true. And so I think this is just a question of experience, of internalizing the incentive structure a little bit better. But fundamentally, in terms of how it's playing with the same idea, I think it does a very good job. Now, is it still an Alexander Pfister game? Yes. So it's baroque. It got rough edges all over the place. It hangs together pretty well, but only largely in comparison to, you know, the already pretty hyper-elaborated versions of Great Western Trail. So yeah, I enjoyed it better than the other versions. I really didn't like Argentina very much as far as Great Western Trail goes. And the base game is... a lot of people have moved past it. You know, a lot of the people have played it a bunch of times. They only want to play it with the expansion, if at all. But I'm not what you would call an expert in any of these trails, but I did very much enjoy New Zealand.
Yeah, the setup's a little more extensive, right? Because you have a lot of cards to organize. But once you get past that, it's not too bad.
Honestly, this is what I think. Can I be crotchety for half a second?
Sure.
And this is not like things were so much better in my day. No, this is just an observation. To my mind, the biggest difference between Euros published around the turn of the century and your average Euro now is, given the same level of weight, not only is the level of weight increased, but given the same level of weight, we're just willing to put up with like a 17-step setup process where a lot of those steps aren't like put out the wood tokens and put them in a supply, but a lot of them are sort these tokens into a particular stack in this way and then shuffle each individual stack and put them in a particular stack. That's step 17. And there's a whole bunch more like that. It's not great.
Or Hansa Teutonica. Put the board on the table.
You have to shuffle some discs.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
Yeah. 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 No, exactly. That's my point. I am willing to do these things, but definitely, you know, halfway through the setup. And those fineries of setup are the kinds of things that you're going to forget first. You know, going back to a game after a month or even a few weeks, just it's a pain. And I wish... I sometimes get the impression that some designers care about this more than others. I generally get the impression that Alexander Pfister is willing to deal with a convoluted setup in a way that a lot of other Euro designers are not.
He did. There is this one thing in New Zealand that I really love. It's been in some of the games. I was trying to remember which ones it was, but you get an upgrade right at the beginning of the game. And,
yeah.
And it is nothing. But still, it's just that it's that feeling of being able to like start your choices right off the stop. You get to grab whatever disc you want and move it over, and now it's a point tracker. But now you have that upgrade right off the hop, and I just love that new mechanism. It's great. That's Great Western Trail New Zealand.
To round out the week, we played some of our favorite fillers. Don't Llama Dice. Walker continues to miss the old days when we were playing incorrectly. We've talked about this before. We used to score every card individually, but the proper rules are to score every class of card once. We originally played with three fives being 50 negative points. It's actually 5 negative points.
Dewey picked up the challenge, though.
Dewey picked up the challenge. He was like, look, I know you've said that high scores are now not possible, but hold my beer. He didn't actually say this. He cracked 50, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it was impressive. For a game that ends at 40, that was impressive. Now, in so doing, he cost me the victory, so I will never forgive him. Don't Llama Dice is a dice game by Rainer Knizia. It is not one of his most decision-heavy designs, but we enjoy, you know, it's fun to roll dice.
Yeah.
That's very much where it fits
in. Yeah, well, it's very, like just round off the day. You know, you're not thinking, you're just chatting, you pass the dice around. It's sort of like a gamer's version of, you know, left, middle, center, where, you know, the they, you know, throw the dice, you move the chits around. And
left, center, right, I think. Left, middle, center would be a very different game.
Gotcha. We also played That's Not a Hat. And for the first time, I felt as though I thought we broke the game.
In the middle, I had that same observation. There was a series of turns where nothing happened because we were all on top of things.
The cards were going around.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, everyone knows all of the cards. We have broken the game and it's just going to go around and around. And then suddenly...
We doubted Casper Lapp.
we did.
Like the first time we played and we thought that, well, this isn't really a game. And no, it turns out that the pain reasserted itself because the thing is, and I fall into the same trap too. You're much better at That's Not a Hat than I am. I can follow the card play if I'm focusing all of my mental effort on where everything is. If anybody so much as asks me what my name is, I will forget something. And I have some heuristics. Like I have to assume that what other people are saying is true most of the time. And so I can remember the cards that are about to come to me and the cards in front of me. Now, that latter part I often forget. Anyway, fortunately, we were broken out of the stalemate, which only lasted like 2 minutes, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
But I had the same concern you did. It was busted wide open when it was either Huey or Dewey. I can't remember. I completely forgot something. And then things degenerated from there.
Then it was done.
Well, because, you're focusing on all the cards. And not only does a new card come in, but you're also laughing at the person who did something wrong. And after laughing, I'm like, wait a minute. Joke's on me. I can't remember anything anymore. That's Not a Hat by Casper Lapp.
Love it. Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills.
This episode is brought to you by the Spring Cleaning Champions, Manscaped. This season, make sure to groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders of the below-the-waist grooming. Clear out that winter bush with Manscaped's Lawnmower 5.0 and watch your confidence bloom like springtime flowers. Embrace the season and join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with our special offer. Go to manscaped.com, use code SOWRONGGAMES for 20% off, plus free shipping. And speaking of spring showers, not to worry, this bad boy is waterproof, shave in the shower, in the bath, in the ocean. Like I said, get 20% off, free shipping, with code SOWRONGGAMES at manscaped.com. That is 20% off, free shipping, with the code SOWRONGGAMES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, bus.
Yes.
They keep saying it's going to be reprinted.
Who's they?
Capstone.
Mm-hmm.
But in their newsletter, they said it's coming out this year.
Okay.
So a splatter game that I've always wanted to try.
Bus. Yes, it's that seldom explored intersection of public transit and time travel.
Exactly so. I remember in the before times when we were doing everything digitally, I had learned it and was ready to teach it, but we never got around to playing it. And so very much looking forward to Bus.
I played Bus once and it physically hurt me.
It looks like it's going to be that type of game.
Oh, it'll burn your brain all right. So we've talked about Burned. We've received a prototype from the designer John Moffat and Stone Circle Games. Burned is a two-player hidden movement game that lasts all of 10 to 15 minutes with a little bit of doublethink, a little bit of playing with toys, a little bit of violence, a little bit of sightseeing, you know, everything you could possibly want. Burned is going to be on Kickstarter as of February the 13th, so it's probably up and crowdfunding already. I'm definitely going to be pledging because I had a great time with my experience with Burned, and I'm very eager to see the different card sets, the different locations, the different spy setups, the different agency setups. Crowdfunding. Burned. February 13th, Kickstarter. Words, not in sentences. Fragments. Nouns. Adverbs.
Simon is not on Kickstarter. Simon has something up only on GameFound. It is another dragon game. What is a Game of Thrones game?
Yeah, it's another one of the dragons. Just
It is another Game of Thrones game. So they have a big sort of miniature game out that they put out already. This is
It's the Song of Ice and Fire miniatures game.
Now this is called a Song of Ice and Fire Tactics.
Yes.
So it's a much lower level type game. Apparently it's supposed to be all interchangeable. So you can have new stuff for your miniature game if you want. But now this is going to be a smaller tactical type game. So if you're into the show or into that kind of thing, this thing might be for you.
Can I complain about something, Walker?
For sure.
For time immemorial, miniatures games companies have been making squad-based versions of their mass battle systems. And they have invariably felt like just chopped down versions of their larger games. I played Mordheim back in the day, back when I didn't know any better, and when the notion of having a campaign was novel. But it felt like a stripped-down Warhammer, and it did not feel like it had been designed for a skirmish environment. And this has been true of lots of other games making their, like, Kill Team. It's like, oh, it doesn't feel like 40K. It's 40K all over again, just with a smaller model count. Now, that's something. Sure, fine. But in my experience, if you want a good, tight tactical game, you usually have to design it from the ground up, like they did with Warhammer Underworlds, as opposed to other things. But who knows? I mean, I don't trust the design chops of Coleman or not to break this general pattern, yes. Suffice to say. But who knows? If you really like the universe, it might be worth a look. If you already have a collection of these miniatures, yeah, then you might be able to use them in this context. Because I'm sure you've got all the people from the show. Like, from whatever faction you've got all the big name people. Like,
all the cool guys. The Dragon Lady.
Well, yeah.
And the Sword Guy.
Yeah, Sword Guy. Sword Guy was a big deal. Him and Master Chief are my favorite fictional characters.
Lady with Bow. these are things that happened, right?
That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our topic, which is deck building. Walker, should we do some history first, or do we want to jump right into...
No, let's do some history, and I've got some other, like, pre-stuff here.
So in the dawn of the universe, by which I mean 2008, Dominion was released. I actually remember the first time I played Dominion. I don't know if I've told this story before. This is one of those cases where, you know, it's kind of a new paradigm. Not entirely unprecedented, but definitely a new spin on a lot of ideas. And subtle, minor rules that you can miss might make all the difference. And actually, this is going to be recurring. I'm going to be talking about it again in the context of deck building. I missed the part where you had to discard your hand at the end of your turn. But I correctly internalized the rule that you drew 5 cards at the top of your turn.
That would be an interesting game of Dominion.
Interesting isn't necessarily the word I would use. Now, it was still sufficiently novel that everyone was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. You use cards to buy other cards that go into your deck. Oh, that's something. I don't know why I've got a 17-card hand full of provinces and duchies and sitting here out, but whatever. And then, of course, I started playing by the actual rules. Immediately, a whole bunch of also-rans followed. 2 salient ones in the immediate aftermath of Dominion in 2008 were Arctic Scavengers and Thunderstone in 2009. I don't know if there were any other immediate follow-ups that you had any experience with, Walker.
No, not that I could put a thumb on, anyway.
Yeah. The next major shake-up to the system was, I think, Mage Knight in 2011, which was, I think, one of, if not the first occasions where somebody said, deck building's cool and all, but I'm not going to make a deck builder. I'm going to use a game with deck building. And that, I think, has been one of the dominant sort of design lineages in Euros for the past few years. Not necessarily the biggest trendsetter, but definitely a recurring thing. So it used to be novel when a game had other stuff going on and there was deck building. And that was definitely true when Mage Knight came out and for a long time afterwards. But now, you know, just look at the games we talked about this week. Great Western Trail is an excellent example of, like, Euros just sometimes like, oh, okay, now you're also doing this deck building thing. Another major shakeup was Ascension. Some people say that the Ascension model of having a rotating market was a big deal. It was, but to a certain extent, Thunderstone had already done that. And so I'm not saying that Ascension's any more or less derivative than any of these other deck builders. It's just I don't necessarily see it as the same huge shift that a lot of other people identify it as. And the Ascension games in turn spawned all the Realms games from Star Realms and then onwards and so forth. And that deck building's everywhere.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is, for those who don't know what deck building is during the game you are purchasing cards from the table and adding them into your hand or usually into the discard pile for you to draw again later, and those cards will improve your deck. And the big difference between what the games Mark just talked about were, in the before times, there was set piles of cards out. It sort of dictated how the game was going to be played.
Like, yeah.
Showed you what strategies there were or how you could build your deck. But when you got to Ascension or Star Realms, it was sort of this rotating market where everyone could purchase from these 7 cards, and it just sort of rotated from there.
Yeah. And again, Thunderstone did the same thing. Thunderstone actually had two different markets, two different currencies in two different markets. One currency was on a traditional Dominion style market. You set out the action cards and those are the ones that are available. And then the other currency allowed you to go kill things. There was some further complication with, the classes. I still have a soft spot in my heart for Thunderstone and its various iterations. I realize that the market has very much moved past this, and I cannot find anyone to be enthusiastic about the Thunderstone Quest, its latest iteration. But nonetheless, I have some fondness for the fundamental thing. And that is one of the reasons why I wish to flag that 5 years before Ascension had the rotating market, Thunderstone also kind of had one, too. A little bit. A little bit.
It's true.
Just a little bit.
All right, so some key elements to deck builders. That's what I have here first. So,
sure.
So usually they have a way to cycle your deck. And there's multiple reasons why you want to do this. Because like I said, usually when you purchase the better cards, they'll go into your discard pile. So you want to get through your current deck so you can get these new cards shuffled into your current deck. But some of the deck builders do interesting things where when you buy the cards, they go right into your hand or they go right to the top of the deck. And we usually find those a lot more interesting.
Yeah, and here's why. This is something I've observed before. The fundamental Dominion formula, I don't mean to pick on Dominion specifically, but the fundamental deck building formula, the ones that don't mess with the Dominion formula too much, they have a level of variance that is seldom fully appreciated. And there are lots of people who would definitely look down their noses at any game with dice that because it's too random and why bother, that would be more than happy to play Dominion or Realms games or what have you. The order in which you draw your cards is massively influential on all the standard deck builders where your purchased cards go in your discard and you discard your hand at the end of your turn. Because you have no ability to craft combos in such instances. All you can do is try to probabilistically increase the likelihood of getting certain combos. And I don't mean combos in the same way necessarily of the village, 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 market, market, action card thing. I just mean combos in the sense of how has your currency been clumping, right? I mean, there's a reason why Dominion cites drafting from Magic the Gathering as an inspiration. You can still see that. The whole notion of land clump or mana screw, if you will, is very, very present in the games of this lineage. I'm happy to play them. I play Shards of Infinity. Shards of Infinity is my favorite quick, light deck builder, right? And it's very much the Ascension sort of lineage of two different currencies, and all the cards come from a central market. But when I sit down to a game like that, cards go in the discard pile, you have to discard your entire hand. I know that I'm engaging in a non-trivial amount of roulette.
Yeah, and Xenoship did a great way to fix that as well, where you automatically freely got currency, and not only that, the currency automatically upgraded to take up less room in your deck.
Xenoshift actually goes one better, because in the entire sphere of co-op deck builders, I don't understand why there are so many co-op deck builders that are unwilling to countenance the idea of cards moving around the different players. When you play a card in Xenoshift, when you buy a card in Xenoshift, it can go to anybody. And so not only does it abstract away from this currency, but it also really just, when you buy the card, it goes into your hand or somebody else's hand. It just goes wherever you want it to go. Mage Knight, as you said, goes to the top of your deck. Imperium, you purchase a card, goes in your hand. And I just feel like that gives you so much more control over things. Imperium, actually, insofar as I struggle with whether or not I would classify Imperium as a quote-unquote pure deck builder. It's clearly more of a pure deck builder than Mage Knight is, because there's a whole lot of stuff going on in Mage Knight than the deck building. And you're kind of building a tableau. Sometimes some nations do an Imperium. Anyway, this is a classification that doesn't matter. But an Imperium, you are not obliged to discard your cards at the end of your turn. You are incentivized to, because you want to shuffle your deck for other reasons, not just to get the new cards. But consequently, I feel like I have more control over things in games like Imperium, games like Mage Knight, games like Xenoshift, than I do in any of the Dominion variants whatsoever.
And then a lot of these deck builders have what we call the bog, right? Where your deck gets penalized and wounds go into your deck.
Mm.
So you're now drawing these wounds instead of the cards that you want. And then you have to figure out ways to get these wounds or curses or whatever the particular game wants to call them out of your hand.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't even matter if they're negative points. The mere fact that they're useless is bad enough. Yeah. And that sort of tempo manipulation, that part of the randomness of card influx, that I'm okay with. You know, if there's these terrible things in your deck, they're going to come up sooner or later. You just have to find a way to mitigate them. That I'm much more down with. It's just when games lean into lots of combo-tastic combos and then tell me that the constituent parts of those combos are going to enter my control randomly, I get a little skeptical. Again, it's not that I refuse to play them. I have a different beef with Dominion. My chief beef with Dominion is that you don't really make decisions with what to do in your hand. The hand plays itself, more or less. You look at the 10 cards that are available to purchase at the start of the game. You decide which ones you want to purchase and in roughly what proportion, and there you go. Then the rest of the game plays itself. But the Dominion stands always say I'm out to lunch on this, and admittedly, I have not played Dominion in about 5 years. So keep in mind, I any of the new stuff, I haven't touched. I do love the blurbs on the back of their boxes, though. Primo.
It's true. And the last part I have here is culling, where you get rid of cards out of your deck.
Mm.
And there's many reasons you want to do this, because usually your starting deck is very suboptimal, and you're getting better and better cards, so you want to start getting rid of your old cruddy cards. So usually games insert a way for you to cull or burn cards out, or maybe a different strategy has opened up and you need to get rid of some other cards, or the curse cards or wound cards that we talked about, the only way to get them out of your deck is to cull them in this way.
Yeah. I sometimes go back and forth on how much I think your initial cards being garbage is crucial to your deck building experience. So just to pick two examples. So there's Albedo. Albedo, your starting cards aren't as good as the other cards you're going to get, but they're still useful. They're really good. And deciding how to send your forces in various ways is still vastly more important than the overall quality of the forces you have. Now, I mean, this breaks down after a while. If I've got a mitt full of fives and you're still stuck with your ones, that's not going to go very far. And then there's things like A Study in Emerald. And here again, I'm going to get into trouble because there are lots of big, big fans of A Study in Emerald. One of my beefs with A Study in Emerald was you'd be engaging in these competitions for cards. And as a rule, the cards you can win in A Study in Emerald are not as good as your starting cards. And so there's this bizarre incentive structure. I was like, why am I doing this? So I think it is not necessary that obviously you don't want your starting cards to be so bad you don't feel like you're doing anything fun. That's not great. But by the same token, you can go way off the deep end. And if your starting cards are too good, well, then there's also a problem.
I'm trying to think of it. Has any game done it like Dominion did it at the beginning, where your big scoring cards are also the cards that are bogging down your deck?
Yeah. So Imperium does that sometimes. Like in point of fact, I'm sorry, I just really like Imperium. Some of the biggest victory cards in Imperium are dead cards. So the ones that are worth, 11, 12, 13 points, those ones you desperately try to find a way to send to your history as fast as possible so they aren't gumming things up. And honestly, a lot of the deck builders that I like do more interesting stuff with those things, like Mage Knight. Wound management in Mage Knight, I think, is much better than Chuff management in Dominion. And of course, in many Dominion setups, you don't have a lot of culling available. I remember back in the early days, when people looked at the cellar and like, cellar, trash up to four cards. Why would I want to get rid of cards? That says, get rid of points. That's losing points. Why would I want to lose points? And I was like, yeah, obviously that's what you want to do. Oh, we were so young and naive back then. And of course, Xenoshift does such a good job of letting you upgrade your units, upgrade your troops, upgrade your currency, that you can feel like you bought the wrong things, but you never feel like, oh, I'm just stuck with this garbage. What do I do with it?
You just give it to the other player.
Suddenly this is explaining a lot.
It's like, oh, this rocket launcher is no good. I think your Marine needs a rocket launcher. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, one of the things that I find super interesting in terms of a lot of recent designs is, again, finding new ways to integrate deck building. So I think I'll give full credit to Alexander Pfister. I think the Great Western Trail games are a truly interesting example of a game with deck building where, number one, you're not just deck building, and number two, it's not even that the deck is driving your actions, right? It's driving your play. But if you contrast it to something like Gatefall or Undaunted, which I absolutely love, and they marry deck building with either, a squad-based miniatures game or a sort of a tactical level World War II game, but there, the actions you do are determined by the cards that you have. Now, parenthetically, I really wish that more people would design games like Gatefall. Like, I would love to have sort of the deck building riff on For What Remains for, you know, David Thompson and maybe Trevor Benjamin to really lean into it. Like maybe just Undaunted the Miniatures game. I don't know. Ascension Tactics came close. I enjoy Ascension Tactics. It's kind of cute, but the scenarios aren't really to my taste. But as somebody who loves tactical games, I really appreciate that more and more people are examining this intersection of tactical skirmish and deck building.
Well, for games that do drive action, Revive is a great system where you use the top and bottom of cards, so you have a lot more choice on how these cards get used.
Yeah. Revive is different from and again, this is the kind of classificational argument that I'm not interested in having, but it's one of those games where you're acquiring lots of cards, but the means by which you acquire cards is a little different from the traditional deck buildery way. And again, I think that's part of the influence of, you know, the long shadow of deck building has really empowered designers to think about, it's like, should people be stuck with the same actions at the end of the game as they were at the beginning? And so we were already well accustomed to the idea of upgrading the potency of actions, but now it's like, well, I'm doing things that I couldn't even do at the start of the game. And I very much appreciate that.
All I got left now are games that I enjoy that have deck building in them.
Sure.
Like Forbidden Stars. Your battle deck is a deck that you slowly build over time. You're building new units and new weapons, and they all get sort of funneled into your battle deck, and they come up when you fight things.
I've forgotten about that, yeah. StarCraft did something vaguely similar, but that was more a function of the units you'd purchased.
And then we both love Core Worlds, and Albedo does the same sort of thing, where the culling mechanism is sort of garrisoning the planets
yes.
that you've just taken over. So it's an interesting way to get rid of your starting awful cards and sort of cycle in the new cool cards.
Absolutely.
We've already talked about Undaunted. It takes deck building to a whole new level where
yeah.
there are a certain number of cards and they yeah.
They particularly how casualties
yeah,
are handled in the deck building.
Yeah, they're like the health of that card.
Yeah.
And cycling them in. And
you still have traditional culling. You have traditional culling for the Fog of Wars that do nothing. And then you have the untraditional culling, which is, my soldier got shot, and now I can't activate his squad anymore.
I also have Botoku in here. You're sort of building your cards up, but it's only a side mechanism to this, you know, elaborate game. And sort of Endless Winter, Paleo Americans is the same sort of thing. It has every mechanism in the game.
Yes.
Deck building is just one of them.
Yeah, they're both reminiscent of the sort of model that I identified with Great Western Trail. You're doing deck building, but the cards aren't the primary driver of your actions. They just interface with other actions you're doing.
We know Alexander Pfister loves deck building because he also did Blackout Hong Kong.
Yes.
Which is another very interesting deck building game.
It's true.
We love Shards of Infinity. And Clank does the same sort of thing. In those two types of games, they've sort of color-coded a lot of the cards. So they're like sort of guilds or gangs, or it gives you this association between groups of cards.
Yeah.
So instead of there's one sort of, like I said at the beginning, one sort of house where all of the cards are out on the table and you can create combos in your head about how these cards intertwine with each other. But if you have this cycle of cards coming from this big deck, it's hard to get combos going because you have no idea what's going to come up. But introducing these sort of gangs or guilds where colors interact will definitely, it brings that out much quicker in those decks.
Yeah, it's a way to help ensure that the combos are more common. You still have a little bit of the problem with the variance, but it tends to minimize it.
And then then we have Faem, right? It is such a weird sort of deck building game because it breaks so many of the traditions of how you cycle your deck.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're playing the cards into the discard, but once you're out of cards or when you want to get cards back, you don't get to go. You get three of them back, and then you have to pay for more. So it's not a deck builder traditionally, but it is still the same sort of idea.
Yeah, to my mind, that is sort of an evolution or an offshoot of deck building, what I'm trying to get people to call hand-building games, like Concordia, like Faem, where you don't draw a random hand. You don't cycle through a discard pile. You have a card that lets you pull some or all of your cards back. And when you acquire new cards, they go into your hand, and you always have the entirety of your hand available to you at any given time. And that, I think, is also a good way to mitigate some of the randomness, some of the variance you're going to find in your traditional deck building models.
And then some games that do deck building on, you know, very slightly. You know, here's one new card that you get to put in your entire decks. Games like Keep the Heroes Out, where they have these sort of items that you might be able to get. You know, you have your normal character deck and you're going through and you're doing your thing. It's like, oh, but now I get a sword and it's going to come through your deck, you know, once or twice during the game. And it's kind of neat.
Same thing with Reiner Knizia's co-op of the Mining Dwarves.
Yes.
Siege of Rundar. There's deck building there. And I think, the more I think about it, if you want to be successful, there will be more deck building. But it is very much possible to play that game without having altered your deck very much. I think that's a way to lose.
Yeah, that's I don't think you play that way.
Yeah, and
you lose that way.
Yeah. Siege of Rundar is an example of a deck builder that does a thing that is not particularly common, which is your deck will always be the same size, right? Every card you buy, another card has to go out. So the purchase and the culling is the same thing. Some of the card crafting games, which are very much deck builders, like Mystic Veil. Mystic Veil is very much the structure of a deck building game, but use the semi-transparent inserts. So you're changing the composition of a given card by John D. Clare. But in Mystic Veil, you always have the same number of cards in your deck, as I recall.
Yes, for sure. And he also did Dead Reckoning. It's a little harder to get sort of the transparencies that go in your cards, so it's a little harder to call it a deck builder because it's not as easy as these other games.
And it's also got a whole bunch of other stuff going on. Edge of Darkness as well. A little bit of deck building on top of a whole bunch of other, and ending up in a sludge of meaninglessness.
This is true.
I don't think they're going to put that on the box.
No, it's not a good, very good catchphrase. Hot garbage, we also put in there. They wouldn't take that either.
That's not a phrase that I use, but I can respect that you do.
The group, minus Mark, also love Northgard, Uncharted Lands. This is another game that's based off a computer game. It has very minor deck building as well. Not so much the fact that, you know, it's the cards that drive your main actions, but at the end of the entire round, you're all going to be adding one more card into your thing. So it's a much slower deck building game.
Yeah, its approach to adding cards is kind of like the way Xenoshift controls currency. Everyone is going to be proceeding at the same pace.
Yes, just so. I also have Taverns of Tiefenhall here. It's a very interesting deck building game. It's very traditional. You know, you're adding a bunch of cards. You're trying to, you know, figure out how to keep in the game longer. You're putting out, you know, tables and all sorts of interesting things, making your bar better.
One of the reasons why I don't enjoy Taverns of Tiefenhall all that much, I'm happy to play it, is it's kind of a throwback to some of my problems with the early deck builders where your hand plays itself. Because, you know, for a long time, the novelty of the conceit, the overall structure, was driving things. But I think as time has gone on, one of the ways in which deck builders have improved, certainly the more substantial ones, is that your hand play is not trivial. You have to decide what to do with your various cards. And Taverns of Tiefenhall, in that sense, felt a little bit like a throwback to me.
Agreed. Like, yeah, much like, you know, original Dominion, you sort of just dump your hand out.
Yep,
more everything or less does what it does, and there's not much you can do about it.
Yeah.
My last thing I have here is an older game that I got rid of and I miss is called Rune Age. This is another of you know, the world that we love, you know.
Tirnanoth.
And it had cooperative elements in it. I really enjoyed how the decks worked. They had all these different races and they all did their own little thing. And it had several different game modes. Had a great expansion. Rune Age, if you ever have a chance to try it, check it out. Another game I don't have on this list is Shadow Rift, another fantastic cooperative deck building game.
Still doesn't let you share cards, though.
Yeah, so weird.
Yeah, unfortunate.
Well, in a way, you have the sort of village, the line of village people, and you sort of decide how they're going to be shared between the players.
You have the police officer, you have the firefighter, you have the construction worker.
Yes, you have Mr. Green in the conservatory with the wrench.
That's not the village people, though. Oh, that's something else.
Oh.
Yeah.
They all hang at the YMCA. It's fun to be there.
I want to be a macho man. And that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our necessary information at sowronggames.com. We read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. We appreciate your having decided to spend some time with us and we hope to see you again soon. Please do take care.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.